WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Has the American dream been achieved at the expense of the American Negro? That was the topic of a February 18, 1965 televised debate out of Cambridge, England.
The debate will open with two undergraduate speakers, one from each side, and then we shall have the first distinguished guest, Mr. James Baldwin, the well-known American novelist who's achieved a worldwide fame with his novel Another Country. Then opposing the motion will be Mr. William Buckley, also an American, very well known as a conservative.
William F. Buckley Jr. was known for his sharp critiques, and he firmly believed the answer to that night's question was no. On the other side, writer James Baldwin argued yes, insisting that the American dream does come at the expense of some more than others.
The trouble in America where the Negro community is concerned is a very complicated one.
It comes as a great shock to discover that the country, which is your birthplace, and to which you owe your life and your identity, has not in its whole system of reality evolved any place for you.
This legendary debate highlights the deep-seated racial tensions that continue to shape the United States today. Now, Chicago's Timeline Theater Company has reimagined how this iconic clash would play out if it were happening in our time. We caught up with two of the lead actors from Debate, Baldwin versus Buckley, to learn more. Tagle F. Bouget plays the role of James Baldwin, and actor Eric T. Miller plays William F. Buckley Jr. Tagle starts us off by addressing the question at the center of this debate. Has the American dream been achieved at the expense of the American Negro?
I don't think it's a difficult question. It's an easy question, actually. And Baldwin says that in the first six lines when he says it is at the expense of the American Negro.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, again, to quote Baldwin, hideously loaded, because we know it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he answers that question in the first couple of minutes, and then for the next 20 minutes, he expounds on why.
Yeah. How were you thinking through the question, Eric, before you tackled the role?
Yeah, in terms of I agree with Tagle that the question is easily answered. It is at the expense of others, including the American Negro. But for me, it was more about trying to figure out how Buckley made this argument against, how to dissect that, and he finds a very circuitous route to trying to answer it, and doesn't really answer it, to be honest with you. In the end, he kind of does the classic conservative look over here, don't pay attention to what we're actually talking about thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in terms of activating it, I just had to make the argument as, you know, as well as I can, because that's the job.
How do you prepare for this role?
A vocal exercises for sure. A little bit of, there's a lot of talking. We each go on for about 25, 30 minutes.
You both have the mannerisms down packed. I was just, you know, watching you and sort of trying to compare, because as you weave through the performance, all the archival footage as well. And so I was watching you, Tagle, you know, just calculating when you take your sip of water, for instance, right?
It's an interesting point, because I am not trying to play James Baldwin. I am using Baldwin's words as Tagle.
Mm-hmm.
And the bit you mentioned with the water, that came out in Chicago. We've been doing this on and off for 4 years plus.
Yeah.
And I liked that little nod. It's a tip of the hat to Baldwin that I discovered here. But I'm not trying to do him. And I've received many compliments about how well I'm doing Baldwin, and I appreciate that. But what it is Tagle, using James Baldwin's words. And the reason I made that choice is because that personalizes it for me, and I'm not trying to do an impersonation. That said, I have some line readings that I know are directly from him.
Yes.
And some physical things that I know are directly from him. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination, but I would say it's 80% Tegel.
Yeah.
Using 100% James Baldwin's words.
And I'll say something. It's funny. When we were in London, because Baldwin's speech is so well known, as it should be, we had someone in the audience say, I loved it, but how come you didn't say it? I picked the cotton. Exactly how, and Tegel was like, well, I'm not, you know, come tomorrow night and I might say it like that. It depends on the evening.
Right,
it depends
on the thing. Right.
But, you know,
and that's one of the great things, too. I'm glad you bring that up, because some people really know the debate well.
Yes.
And the other night, I was approaching the line when I say the reason America was able to do what they did because of cheap labor.
Yes.
And before I got there, the guy up by the big screen, he looked at me, he said, cheap labor.
Yeah,
and I wanted to say, I'll do the show.
That man wanted nothing to do with me once I started talking. I say that. He did not.
Well,
he wouldn't even look me in the eyes.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to bring up the woman who was sitting next to me when I watched the show last week. She was also sort of mouthing some of the words as you went along, Tegel. But she, in the talk back that you have after the performance with the audience, she said to you that night, Eric, that you're listening to you do Buckley was painful. And we talked about how disturbingly cyclical things have become, right? Because this is the 60th anniversary of this debate.
Tomorrow,
right? Tomorrow is exactly 60 years since the two gentlemen, you know, performed. And so it was eerie to think about how the discourse that we're seeing today just mirrors what Baldwin was saying and what, you know, and how Buckley opposed.
That's exactly how this came about. I mean, after the murder of George Floyd in 2020, a director that I'd worked with, Christopher, at the American Vicarious, called and said, do you want to come with my friend Tegel and read this? And I knew of Baldwin's part of the debate. I didn't know it was part of a debate. I didn't know. I just knew the speech.
Right.
And we got in a room and read it. And then Chris said, is this still relevant? And we both were like, I mean, it's as if I heard this yesterday. And so it's to your point. I mean, that's why we continue to do it. And Tegel and I joke about wanting to have a world where, like, well, we don't need to do it anymore because it's no longer relevant. But I doubt that that'll happen before I die, you know, unfortunately. So it will continue to be relevant.
I want to talk about your performance too, Eric. Because I mean, I felt you worked the room very well as Buckley.
Thank you.
Just kind of going around and dealing with the interruptions from the crowd as well.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that, because there was one moment I wasn't sure if it was real.
Good, that's what we want.
I was alarmed. And I think maybe the gentleman that you called out might have also been like, oh, was I,
yeah,
was I talking
I do
out
wanna
of turn?
Say, we do say that it's you know, interactive or participatory. If you don't want to be interactive or participate in it, we will not come after you. This is not something where you have to.
Right.
We look around, you know, the lights are up. I'm looking you in the eyes.
Yes.
I'm making the argument. It's very clear when someone doesn't want to talk to me and they look down. But if you're engaged with me, especially if you look angry, my job is I want you to be angry. You should be angry that this man was given this platform to spew this vile nonsense.
Well, that worked, because I was directly across from that gentleman that you sort of had the back and forth with about, you know, making sure he listens to what you're saying. And I was shook. I was like, okay, I'm going to be on my P's and Q's too, you know, because he's going to come after me next.
I think that happens to a lot of people after that happens.
After that moment. But in the real debate, were there three?
There were three, yes. And we originally did all three. The first one is a point of order that Buckley kind of brushes aside. The second one is the one that's still in the piece, where someone says, point out a piece of literature where Baldwin ever said that he wants to get rid of civilization, which he did not, for the listeners at home, ever say that. Buckley twists it in a way that we see today, where you take something out of context and say, oh, look at this.
Mm-hmm.
This is what this means. The third one was about someone saying, let them vote in Mississippi. And there was another little diatribe that Buckley has about how, you know, not only does he want to give black people the vote, but he also thinks not as many white people should be voting, because he believed in an intelligence test before he should vote, because however you want to unpack that.
Yeah.
And that one, and it didn't lend itself as to the theatricality of the piece. It's verbatim, except for keeping those two things out.
I see.
We did, when we were in London, the gentleman who does say let them vote came and saw the debate, and for that night we put that back in so that he would he wouldn't be forgotten in that. But yeah. But yeah.
Interesting.
It's also why I think of it as a reimagining, because things like that are left out. We are in the round here. We've done it on proscenium stages, which they didn't do. So it's a reimagining of that using all of the language.
What's it like for you as an artist performing in the round, from your perspective?
In some ways, it's more difficult because someone is going to always have your back.
Yes.
Which is unfortunate. But you deal with that.
Yeah.
And there are pros to it, too. You're sort of in a in an arena. Mm-hmm. You're in the middle of an arena, which is nice. But the challenge is giving something to everyone.
Yeah.
So you have to work the room.
You chose
Baldwin
individuals, and you literally stood next to them for minutes at a time and just talked to that person.
And that personalized it, and that made it more personal.
Mm-hmm. One audience member, you know, as I mentioned, she talked about the pain. I remember another reflecting on this one portion where Baldwin talks about how what's happening to you, you know, as a Negro hits different once you're 30 years old. Remember that stretch of the speech, of course?
Yes.
I know you know that well. I'll just read just a little bit of it here, and I want to ask you a question on the back end. So he talks about, you know, he says, by the time you are 30, you have been through a certain kind of mill. And the most serious effect of the mill you've been through is, again, not the catalog of disaster, the policemen, the taxi drivers, the waiters, the landlady, the landlord, the banks, the insurance companies, the millions of details, 24 hours of every day, which spells out to you that you're a worthless human being. It's not that. It's by that time that you've begun to see it happening in your daughter or your son or your niece or your nephew. You're 30 by now, and nothing you have done has helped to escape the trap. And he goes on and on.
Yes.
I've got to tell you, Tegel, when you delivered that section, it rocked me to
my core.
I thought about my own life. You know, I thought about my own children. I have two teenagers, and I thought of conversations that we've had at home where I've heard them express scenarios that I never dreamed they would encounter.
That's one of the sections that it's the easiest for me to personalize because my father and mother, but particularly my father, so many times told me both of my parents grew up, were from Louisiana. Grew up in the South, migrated to California. I was born in Louisiana, but don't know it well. But Daddy would say so many times, he would tell me these horrible stories, and he said, Daddy sure doesn't want that for you, T. Daddy sure doesn't want that for you, T. And their big thing was for me, as many parents, I believe, have me to have a better life than what they have. So
absolutely.
I think of that every time I do that part of the monologue.
Yeah, he says, you know, what's worse than that is nothing you have done, and as far as you can tell, nothing you can do will save your son or your daughter from meeting the same disaster and not impossibly coming to the same end. Yeah. Tears when you delivered that. Now, Eric, tell me, when you're going through this and you're, you know, preparing to put this reimagining on stage, do you have to go back and fact check things?
I mean, I've looked through his arguments and what he says and the things that he offers as truth. I find it very revealing that at one point later in the monologue, he says, if you can stand a statistic not of my own making, which to me is a bit of a tacit admission that some of the things that he said may have been either taken out of context or should you. But I mean, the book that he talks about, Beyond the Melting Pot by Professor Glaser, that was debunked in the early 80s, late 70s. I mean, it is hideously loaded with much bias and much, you know. And so, I mean, there's very few things that I, as Eric, agree with. I agree with, he says, one thing I've told Tegel this. He says, there is no instant cure for the race problem in America. I say, okay, I agree with that, Mr. Buckley. I agree with that
statement.
There
is no instant
cure. That one I can drop the pretense.
Because we're still dealing with it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
But
so
everything
not.
Else, I mean, it's, again, I have to make the argument. That's the job. I think it's very important to Buckley to win the debate.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of what he's saying, I mean, it's almost all, there's a perfect example that I always use where he says, we know there was more bloodshed here in the British Isles trying to bring emancipation to the Irish than has been shed by all the people, 10 times the amount of people as have been lynched as a result of the delirium of race consciousness, race supremacy in the United States since the days of the Reconstruction. When I first heard that, I thought, is that true? There were more people, yeah, since the days of the Reconstruction. That's 1865. That's the end of the Civil War. So if you want to negate the 300 years that came before that, that sentence may be true. But you don't think that. You think, wait, there were more. And now he's got you, right? Because now you're thinking that what you knew, you don't know. And now he's gotten in, and now he's got you questioning what you think.
I mean, these alternative facts, you will, plus the way you, Eric, were staring at some of us, it was so believable at times. And you thought to yourself, wait, no.
Yeah, I know that.
Wait a minute.
Well, someone said the other day, someone commented afterwards, he said, and so gaslighting was born. And it was like, exactly.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. So we got Baldwin and we have Buckley very far apart in their worldviews. But I feel like I saw a level of respect among men.
I mean,
how do you portray that?
Well, I don't think you have to portray it. We are lucky because in 65, the form of the debate is so foreign to today.
It was so formal.
It was formal, and you don't shout the opponent down. Mm-hmm. You listen, you're in a room together, and we don't have that anymore. And almost every talkback we have, someone points out that how much they appreciated that.
Yeah. I mean, just look at the conversations today on social media alone. Yeah. I mean, it gets very ugly.
Yeah.
And I do find it interesting, and this is not a comment, but sometimes some of the universities that we'll go to, we've had some of the younger audience members leave when I start talking. Or
really?
Because they just don't want to hear it. And I'm like, well, that's not the answer either, everyone. As much as you disagree with this person, in this format, you had to listen to what they said so that then you can unpack it and combat it, and try to have a real conversation. But if you don't hear it and you just want to say, I don't, la, 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 that's not going to help anything. And I fear that's gotten us to where we are now.
So make it clear, what is the objective here, right? You talked earlier, Tegel, about, you know, I'm not trying to redo Baldwin. I'm not trying to be Baldwin. I'm not trying to be Buckley. What are you trying to do?
Well, Baldwin said after this debate, he wins the debate 544 to 164. And he said that he won the battle, but Buckley wins the war.
Mm-hmm.
Because what Baldwin wants and says throughout is power. We need power. We don't have power. Both pieces are warnings ending in threats. But he has the power. So his threat is a more powerful threat. So why do it? The reason I believe that Baldwin went to Cambridge to do that was to expose those people and eventually the world from a very personal point of view, what was going on in America.
Yeah.
He didn't think he was going to leave the Cambridge Union and things were going to change overnight. He knew that. He was pleased that he won the debate, but he kept it in perspective.
Yeah.
I won the battle. He wins the war. He has the power. The playing field is not even.
So as an actor, what do you take away from this project and maybe apply to the next role? What little thing?
Well, it's for me, I will say, it's very rare that you have a piece that you can work with on for 4.5 years sporadically.
Right.
And something Philip Seymour Hoffman used to always say was, you know, don't play the character. You do all the work and all the research and all the homework to create the character. Then on the day, you have to ease off the character and just let it be. And that's something that this has taught me just on an artistic level, how to do that, because it's so in my bones, the language, that I could do it to a taxi cab driver. I could do it anywhere, anytime. So easing off of that. And for me, to your previous question, I just want to say it's important to me with this. William Buckley is a very celebrated figure. This is a man that was given a television show for 40 years, one of the most successful shows in America. He was a trusted financial advisor of President Reagan.
Yeah.
The man that said these things that I say was given a television show for 40 years. A man that put in print in his own magazine, The White Race is the Superior Race, was given a megaphone for 40 years. So when we talk about systemic racism, when we talk about these things, this is what we're talking about.
Feels
and so if
like
I can have someone. Yeah. And if I can have someone who says, I grew up idolizing Buckley and this made me think differently about him.
Yeah.
Good.
That is Tegel F. Bouget and Eric T. Miller. Folks, go see it. Debate Baldwin versus Buckley. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by me and Ellie Gilbert-Bear. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and mixed by Micah Yasin. To make sure you never miss an episode, hit subscribe wherever you listen or find us at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.